Welcome back to the first network break of 2021. As of this recording, we are 8 days in, and wow, what a start. We're going to do our best to move forward with some timely tech news analysis. And Greg, happy new year to you.
Yeah, isn't it great to be here? Like, I feel like Christmas and New Year was a bit weird. I was in lockdown here in the UK, which is where I live. And really, I did a lot of traveling between the sofa to the kitchen to the desk, uh-huh. And then back to the sofa again, and then once every 4 days I went to the shops to pick up some supplies. That was it. That was my Christmas and New Year, and it was pretty luscious, I must say. It was great.
I too hunkered down at home and got very relaxed, so forgive any mental lapses that I may have on this recording because my brain is out of shape.
Yes, well, congratulations on not dying. I think that's an excellent effort, to be fair.
And you.
That's
And anyone
like
else
set the bar
who made
low.
It.
Set the bar low, achieve high.
That's, there we go. It's all up from here.
It's all up from here, yep.
All right, let's do a little business before we start. You can join Palo Alto Networks on January 14th at 10 a.m. Pacific for their Securing Today's Work From Anywhere World webinar. You can learn about trends that are shaping remote work in the short and long term, rethinking infrastructure to ensure corporate resources are secure and available 24/7, and transforming the networking and security to align with the needs of remote workforces with Prisma Access. You can register at register.paloaltonetworks.com/securing-work-from-anywhere. We'll also have that in the show notes. And stay tuned after the news. There's a Tech Bytes podcast sponsored by Silver Peak. We're going to discuss an SD-WAN deployment with our customer Simon Med. Simon Med's a medical imaging company dealing with massive and sensitive patient data.
And he talked numbers, how much money he'd saved from doing an SD-WAN deployment.
That, yes, it's a fun conversation. He's a great guest, so
yeah,
check it out.
He was cool, dude. He wasn't shy and pretty upfront.
He has opinions.
I wonder who else does that.
Yeah, I wonder.
It's refreshing, isn't it?
Yes. All right, let's dive into the news. So back in December 2020, news broke that software sold by SolarWinds had been compromised, enabling attackers to get access to thousands of organizations, including U.S. government agencies and many, many businesses. The intrusion was facilitated by a compromised DLL that hid malware, and when activated, the malware phoned home to command and control servers and gave attackers a foothold to land and expand, map networks, steal credentials, and escalate privileges.
I think the main thing about the SolarWinds breach is that governments noticed, and particularly the press seemed to center around the U.S. government being compromised. Mm-hmm. And as we talk now around the 8th of January, the general consensus is that this was a Russian operation. Now, whether the Russians simply took advantage of the situation or whether they actually conducted an operation to compromise the SolarWinds software build system is unclear. We may never know, but the U.S. Secret Services are definitely involved in giving SolarWinds a very much a hard time. They issued edicts to the U.S. government to immediately switch off all SolarWinds products that relate to this breach. No questions asked, just turn them off immediately, mm-hmm. and then gave out quite comprehensive details on how to conduct a remediation action to detect if the breach has gone very far. Now that we are a couple of weeks down the road, this breach is actually very bad and probably much worse than we can understand in the way that the SolarWinds build system was actually compromised, and every time they rebuilt the malware and then rebuilt the software and then distributed it, the malware was automatically built in and distributed to everybody's software. The malware was on-premises and then was able to be used to get remote access to sites and then pivot out. The malware was quite stealthy and was able to do a number of different things. Mm-hmm. And there may have been two different actors. This is not yet clear. There may have been two different sets of organizations who picked up on the vulnerability and then started loading their own malware. The malware that was in there was obfuscating, that is, it was looking for specific targets, and if it was in certain places, it would stop trying to communicate with home. So a lot of organizations who may have been infected or may have been impacted may not necessarily have suffered an intrusion, because this appears to have been targeted to government services where SolarWinds was monitoring networks and servers inside of those infrastructures. So it is very bad. It's very bad for SolarWinds. I don't think SolarWinds will suffer here. I think ultimately SolarWinds will do an Equifax. They'll be back.
Oh,
no
sure.
one cares, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting that there may be little repercussion to SolarWinds as a business for this. We'll see what happens when folks need to resign and, you know, what their fortunes look like going forward. But we have seen in the technology industry very little repercussion for significant security breaches.
It's very difficult because what you've got now is a situation where if the government tried to say to SolarWinds, right, you've done something very bad, we're taking you down on the grounds of national security, say, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't fix the software. What you actually want is somebody who's going to fix the software and or whatever. I know that when I talk to various people, a lot of organizations just switched it off and threw it out. Mm-hmm. They don't need the product. A lot of the products that were under threat, particularly Orion Network Manager, not critical to a lot of organizations. It's kind of like a useful tool. It's one of those products that everybody has, but nobody really knows what it does. For a lot of organizations, some organizations are very dependent upon it and they were very quick to act and to isolate it and so forth. But that said, SolarWinds has a pretty long history of not taking a lot of care with its products. And this is kind of this sort of level of compromise is indicative of an organization that's not spending time focused on security. So its build system, its distribution system was compromised and it was probably compromised for over 9 months. And they did not detect this at any point over that period.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most frightening aspects of this is that the software was signed by SolarWinds with the malware inside, which means that their development pipeline was compromised. So it's not like they shipped code and then found a vulnerability later on and tried to fix it. The malware was sent to customers. That is frightening. Because it makes me wonder how many other mid-sized software companies with lots of customers are being or have been targeted in a similar way.
From what we saw in the wash-up over the last 3 or 4 weeks of all the things going on, is that it apparently seems to have been very much focused on getting inside of a government. It was the Russian secret services have been fingered, and this assumption is that they've gotten inside these organizations and they've put some other sort of persistent access in. So they've leveraged this, pivoted into the organization, and they've got other accesses in, and they're accessing data out of these government departments. Now, the same would apply to the UK or the French government or the German government as well. We just haven't heard anything because of the reaction from the US government was very public and very strong. It's really going to determine the outcome's going to be how negligent was SolarWinds in this. If SolarWinds was genuinely negligent, and it is owned by a private equity firm, if you consider that in operations, when you're owned by a private equity firm, they're often trying to turn it around so they can do something to it, maximize its capital value, and then sell it back on to the next sucker, right? Uh-huh. And one way to do that is to cut costs. Uh-huh. So stop doing security checks, stop doing security training, stop doing penetration testing on your systems because, you can – don't worry about that next year. That's a good risk. We accept that risk, what's going on there. But it'll be interesting to see how well SolarWinds weathers that. If it can weather that like Equifax did, Equifax sort of run around apologizing every day, saying, we're very sorry, we're going to fix it, we're very sorry, we're going to fix it, and then came out the other side, and so on for all the other major breaches. I mean, even in the last 2 weeks, there's been over 30 breaches of organizations that we don't talk about on this show. It's just so many of them that this is actually not that big a deal in the real scope of things, except for the fact it was probably a foreign actor at state level and assumed to be the Russians. At least that's what the American government is saying today.
Yeah. So I know we're coming to the SolarWinds story late because we were on break while it happened, but Microsoft has a detailed article that really breaks down how the DLL was compromised and also really goes through the well-thought-out steps the attackers took to disguise their presence. It's very much worth reading, particularly if you are developing software for customers. You'll find that link in the show notes. I encourage you to check it out.
And there are some impacts here. I want to think about things like Cisco's licensing servers and how we get streamed updates. So you have various tools from the vendors and you just click them and they go and update the code on your switches, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Those are all supply chain attacks.
Yes.
And up until now, we've been able to trust, in inverted commas, those systems because there's never been a vulnerability. But it is now reasonable to start questioning your vendor. What are they doing to validate the integrity of these patches, of these updates? And this is something that you might want to write. My point is that even if you're a customer of SolarWinds, you have no legal liability back on them the customer is stuck with the results here.
Yes. Yep. Mm. Yeah.
Which is dire, to be right. Not only are you stuck with the vulnerability and the damage to your business if SolarWinds, you know, was the anchor, you're also stuck with the cost of fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also stuck with the cost of preventing it from happening again.
Right.
So there's no incentives here for vendors like SolarWinds or any of our IT vendors to actually do better, which is the interesting thing to think about. They have zero incentive here because all of the cost, all of the risk is borne by the customer.
Right.
And they have no incentives to do better in terms of, you know, a little bit of brand damage is fine. You know, SolarWinds share price is down, you know, 20% or 30%. But I have every belief that it'll, you know, in a year's time, this will be forgotten and no one will care.
Well, the next big one will come along and we'll fret about that and nothing will change.
Yep. Et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, this is so cheerful to start.
Yes.
All right, let's carry on. So many tech workers came back to their desks Monday after the New Year's holiday to find that Slack, the popular chat platform, was having difficulties that included degraded or intermittent performance to full-on outages. Slack's status page began acknowledging problems around 10 a.m. Eastern time on U.S. on Monday, January 24th.
Yeah, Slackforce. Of course, Slack is being acquired by Salesforce. I doubt this had anything to do with that. All they're doing is saying, we're truly sorry. That's it. We don't really know much more than that, do we?
No, I don't think we do. Their status update page just says, yeah, we apologize for the inconvenience, essentially.
And as Australians would say, that's pretty slack. Like, that's pretty casual. Why, you know, where's the post-mortem to say this is a problem and can we trust Slack again? You know, until customers start balking at these vendors and saying, you know, that's not good enough. We're actually going to, and putting clauses in their purchasing agreements with vendors to say, you must be reasonably competent. Or we'll sue you, I don't think anything will change. So,
Yeah, I think part of the issue for this is that Slack, besides just being, you know, an asynchronous chat platform, is now being tied into lots of tool chains, chat ops, essentially. So it's being integrated with other products and systems. And so if Slack goes down, then that's a broken link in your chain, which can affect other systems and overall productivity. And that's not great. So, yeah, Slack has some work to do internally.
Yeah. You know, and we all say, oh, you know, the market will decide who's the right company and, you know, the bad companies will be weeded out. That isn't actually what we're seeing.
Well, the other thing, I mean, I should say that every company has outages or software difficulties. So it's not like there's any perfect example that we can point to and say, be more like them.
Yeah, that's the challenge, right?
Yeah.
But there's also no incentive to actually be good.
I guess the one incentive is that, you know, Salesforce now has Slack and Microsoft has Teams and those two are going hammer and tongs at it. So I guess that incentive is that competitive incentive is
but
there.
But you didn't buy Teams because of its quality.
No, you bought it because it came with Microsoft Office 365.
Yeah. And if you've got Slack, you know, these products are designed to be incredibly sticky and monopolistic. So, you know, arguably. But, you know, I would prefer Slack over Teams generally. It's something that most people can get their head around. I just wish we could have some more transparency and some more quality, which is a common refrain from me, of course.
Of course. Yeah, we use Slack here internally, and when it was out, I was like, I have to email somebody? What is going on here? This is savage.
It's always email. It always works.
Yes, right. Yep. All right, Greg, you had mentioned private equity earlier. They play into this next story. The technology training site Pluralsight is selling itself to a private equity firm for approximately $3.5 billion. Vista Equity Partners is buying Pluralsight for just over $20 a share.
This is kind of boggling to me in a way. Like Pluralsight fundamentally gets a bunch of professionals in the industries that they're in, started out in technology, of course, and then acts as an aggregator to make those courses available to other people, you know, pretty much just an IT training site. And the fact that it's suddenly worth $3.5 billion is kind of boggling.
My jaw dropped at that figure, yes.
Yeah. So I'm guessing, you know, last time I checked, they had about $200 million in revenue. That's a couple of years ago when I last sort of dug into it. So this company really believes that this side of online learning, but also the fact is that Pluralsight doesn't generate its own content. It subcontracts out the content creation,
yes,
if you like.
Yep.
And Pluralsight authors. My guess would be is that for people like you and I, who may have a Pluralsight subscription, this is probably bad because I think they'll raise the pricing. It's probably Pluralsight's pricing has been modest and reasonable for quite some time. And I think we're going to see a much more expensive cost. You know, we're already seeing it getting up towards $250 a year, and a premium layer is added on top at $400 a year. I think it'll go up, and I'll also think they'll squeeze the authors because they've got the choke control.
Yep.
And the authors today are well paid, reasonably well paid. They're motivated. A lot of people are actually made careers out of just producing content for the Pluralsight, and they get paid on a volume basis. So they work for nothing. They just work on a commission consumption fee. Mm-hmm. And if Pluralsight stops paying them, then the quality drops, and then you end up with, you know, something that's not as sustainable. It starts to look more like O'Reilly Safari, which is okay, but not awesome.
Yeah, I am always wary when a private equity company picks up a firm, because we know the typical business model is to slash costs to the bone, which can affect quality. We'll see what happens, because obviously the thing that drives Pluralsight is the quality of its instruction. And so if they skimp on that, then they are hurting the brand.
Well, the challenge around Pluralsight is, how do you make $3.5 billion worth of value out of IT skills training?
Yes.
Like, that doesn't... Like, you know, I understand that you can sell it as a team subscription and, you know, blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. But $3.5 billion worth of value implies that you're going to draw $12 to $20 billion worth of revenue out of a company over a 3 to 5 year cycle. That means that they expect it to do something else. If it stops being an IT platform and becomes, you know, courses on how to write your first book type.
Right. Yes. Uh-huh. More for the general consumer hobbyist kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and my guess would be they're saying, well, this is working for an IT training platform. We could take that model and do it for anything else. That's, you know, do you want to learn how to be a painter, you know, or something?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
How to play
and
the
I think
guitar.
That would degrade the value of it.
Yeah. I am having a hard time getting my head around the $3.5 billion, but the press release quotes Vista, the private equity firm, as saying, quote, "We have seen firsthand that the demand for skilled software engineers continues to outstrip supply." So they, I guess, feel like they've got a commodity. You know, when demand is high and supply is low, that's
we've been saying that for 30 years.
To be in. But the other thing we see is that enterprises aren't doing their own internal training. They want to outsource that. So maybe they're positioning this as sort of your training outsourcing company.
Yeah, this is the training you have when you don't have training. Here's a subscription. It's costing me $25 a month.
Right.
There you go. That's your training plan. Bug off and stop asking me questions.
Right.
You know, it's a bit cynical.
And also digitally
of me,
innovate. Go.
Yeah, that's right. And it's remotely delivered and it's self-paced. So, you know, if I'm an IT manager, I can say, like, here's your training thing. Go and do that. That's really not working for me. That's not my problem. It's a self-paced training program. You go and do it. You know, that's
right. Don't do it while you're at work, though.
Yeah, wash my hands of it. It's your fault now, right?
Right. Do it
it's a brilliant scam.
It's on you.
Brilliant grift.
Yes.
Yeah. And $25 a month is way cheaper than $4,000 for a VMware training course that you have to attend in a limited number of locations, and it has to be managed by VMware, right?
Right. Yeah. So maybe that's the play. I don't know. In any case, maybe we can put on the first prediction of 2021 that prices will go up and payments to creators will go down.
Well, the other side of this, and I didn't actually put it in the show notes, but I'll tell you, is that I noticed today that Juniper has announced its own self-study bundles for some of its courses, JNCIE, which is their top-level certification class, and they're charging about $600 for a self-study course.
Hmm.
So maybe the reaction to that is we start seeing the vendors realize that they're losing control of the quality or the pace of the education or the relevance of the education and start doing it themselves. It's not all that expensive to produce an education program around self-study.
No, particularly if you're the vendor who knows the technology and has people on hand to teach it, yes.
Yeah.
Interesting times in the IT education market, but let's move on. On December 23rd, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, announced that all 1,195 generic top-level domain name servers have implemented DNSSEC. If you're not familiar with DNSSEC, it uses digital signatures to authenticate DNS data to thwart DNS spoofing and things like man-in-the-middle attacks.
So the reason that I put this into the notes is to say, like, that's just now. DNSSEC has been around for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was RFC'd like 10 years ago. And ICANN, which is theoretically the overseeing body for all things DNS, has really done nothing to make this happen. It's just sort of, let it happen. You know, you should do it. You should do it. And finally, they've all done it. I really feel that ICANN has this sort of laissez-faire, doesn't want to interfere, the market will decide its own thing. But that's not really what we need. If we want DNSSEC and network integrity to be in play, ICANN should have been forcing these TLD domain owners to implement this years ago. Mm-hmm. It just boggles my mind that DNSSEC has only just been completed for all existing TLD domain names at Christmas. Mm-hmm. That is not good. That is a very bad thing for, you know, and they run around going like network security and we want the network to be free of interference. And it's taken them this long to do the most basic task, which is just to say to the people that own the domain names, pull your finger out and get something done.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't call this a basic task. You're talking about public key infrastructure and you're talking about DNS, two very complex systems that you need to get absolutely right or they don't work. And that affects the entire internet. So I could see them moving with maybe a pace that we would say is too slow.
But the people who run these TLDs, they have responsibilities and they own everything comes from ICANN. Mm-hmm. Right. So ICANN owns all of the domain infrastructure. They should be able to mandate to these people, you must act.
So you're saying, and you would have liked to see ICANN put more pressure on?
I think we need to see a more active intervention. These organizations really need to stop. You know, like ICANN and IETF are very sort of like, well, you know, we'll just talk about it. And if you like it, you can use it. And we're not going to force you. You've got to want to want it. You know, you've got to want the change, you know, sort of thing. And I'm like, No, you need to really come down and make a decision here. And if this is the thing that's happening, you need to make it happen. You need to drive it. You need to encourage it. Like, for example, one place where they've had great success is with Manners and forcing people to sign their BGP routes with RPKI. Uh-huh. That's been a success. They've done that very well. Why was that not done for this? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, maybe because it's DNS and it's so critical and so complex. And again, PKI, very difficult. And you absolutely have to get that aspect of it right. Maybe that was part of it, but I don't know. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I take your point that more speed would have been appreciated or at least more emphasis on you must get this done.
Yeah, I think the ICANN can't sort of be like it used to be, which is like a casual volunteer, you know, we'll do it when we do it. That sort of, it must be much more forceful and interactive with what's happening. If it chooses to support something, it needs to make it happen.
Well, link in the show notes if you want to read about it. Quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Palo Alto Networks. We all know that remote work, distributed work is the new reality, and the expectation among employees is simple. Flexible work is here to stay. They want it. Unfortunately, it means a greatly expanded attack service is an unwelcome side effect that exposes organizations to more risk. And as a result, businesses are scrambling to ensure their remote workers and essential IT resources remain available and secure everywhere. So you can join Palo Alto on January 14th, 10 a.m. Pacific for a new interactive webinar where they're going to discuss trends shaping remote work in the short and long term, rethinking infrastructure to ensure corporate resources are secure and available 24/7, and transforming networking and security to align with the needs of remote workers with Prisma Access from Palo Alto Networks. You can sign up today, register.paloaltonetworks.com/securing-work-from-anywhere. That's register.paloaltonetworks.com/securing-work-from-anywhere, or find the link in the show notes for today's Network Break 315. All right, back to the news. Project Dent, this is a new network OS hosted by the Linux Foundation, and the first code release called Arthur is now available. And yes, you may have noticed the Linux Foundation is using the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy nomenclature for whatever that's worth.
Nice that you noticed. I thought you would. You are a bit of a Hitchhiker's Guide fan.
I am
suspect.
A bit of a fan. I am, yes.
Bit of a fan. It was a good book, a good series of books.
Yep.
I'm going to be interested to see how this goes. I think the demise of Cumulus in particular might be giving Dent some legs. I thought Cumulus had pretty much gotten out the legs, but we've also got competitive products to this, like companies like Arcus and DriveNets and others who have very viable, near open source, low cost operating systems that scale up to a massive size. As we've talked about before, Dent is largely led by a crew from AWS.
Amazon, actually, not AWS.
Amazon,
yep.
Yeah. And they feel that if they could contribute a NOS back to the community, there'd be something there. And the fundamental design principle here is that they believe that the NOS would be better served if all of the functions were encapsulated in the kernel.
Yep.
Whereas most other NOSes use user space for the features and the functions, which means they don't have to go to the kernel and get them mainlined, and that gives them a lot more flexibility, and they don't have to be dependent on the Linux kernel people to get their stuff done, if that makes sense.
Yes, to that end, this NOS is using SwitchDev. That's a driver that does, as you mentioned, sit in the Linux kernel space and provides essentially a common set of interfaces for the ASICs underneath.
I'm much more of a fan of Sonic. I think ultimately AWS may have a particular view about how things should work, but Sonic has a lot more commitment and has a lot more runway here. What is it? You took the briefing, and do you think there's anything in this that makes it more likely to win compared to Sonic? I don't think we've got the capacity in the market to support lots of these.
My understanding and Amazon's involvement was that they are looking for very specific use cases. This is not a data center NOS. This is not a campus NOS. It's not really even an enterprise NOS. It's focused on the retail sector in particular. Mm. You know, Amazon has this initiative where they want to build out a whole bunch of retail grocery stores and other retail locations. And so they need a network platform because they want to build these highly automated retail locations. And so they need network support for that. So they want a cheap, low-cost NOS, and that's what they built here. And now they've shunted it over to the Linux Foundation to maybe build a little bit of community around it and to attract manufacturers and ASIC vendors, which they have done, because some of the partners in this project are EdgeCore, Marvell, Innovium, and NVIDIA.
So more of a campus play, like a small campus play?
No, again, the edge. Well, and the edge, by which I mean really retail edge. They're also talking about maybe some telco, you know, colo office spaces. But it's really, this is not necessarily a NOS targeted at the typical enterprise.
Yeah. So what I mean is small campus.
Yeah.
So small not campus. Enterprise campus.
Small data center, I guess I would say. Yeah. Regional remote data centers.
Edge data center or small POP type stuff.
Right.
Where all you really want is some Ethernet and some routing.
Essentially, yes. And to that end, they also support FRR free range routing on top.
It'll start simple and get okay, is that really going to work? Are people really going to go out and buy a white box switch and then install an operating system? Or are they just going to go and buy a Unify, Ubiquiti, Aruba, Meraki product?
Again, I really feel like this is Amazon saying, we want a network OS for our own purposes. We'll give it to the Linux Foundation to sort of put some shine on it.
Amazon doesn't do that. Amazon doesn't create open source projects and share them.
But in this case, they have.
That makes me question it, right? This seems to be exceptional.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If AWS had a long history of contributing to open source and being a viable member of the community and supporting open source projects instead of co-opting them just to make more money itself, like, you know, it did with MongoDB and a range of other, you know, Postgres and all that sort of stuff.
But that's what I think this is. This is Amazon looking out for its own interests. If it can put this into the Linux Foundation, then somebody else essentially is looking after it. They can, you know, throw a few developers over, but they've got the Linux Foundation as a body to sort of give them a nice, tidy, clean network OS that they can then take advantage of. And they don't have to worry about it so much. They can focus on other things.
And again, you know, the Linux Foundation is a place for these projects to live, but they don't sell them. They don't drive them. If you know what I'm saying.
Right.
So they give you a framework for where the projects can exist and be sustained, but where's the part of it? And generally the sort of assumption is that if you create an open source project, then they will come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure I'm seeing that.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I don't anticipate a large community coalescing around Dent. I think this is very much a special purpose, sort of built to purpose OS that for whatever reason, Amazon decided let it live in the Linux Foundation.
What I could see is somebody like Meraki, Unify, you know, Ubiquiti, one of those companies that operates, focuses on the small edge network thing, could adopt this and turn it into, bring it into their products.
That's certainly possible. I mean, it is a Linux-based NOS, and so if you've got a box, you can run it.
Yeah, and basically then they can focus on a cloud platform that will allow them to exploit the revenue opportunity by saying you have to pay us, you know, $200. The operating system's free, but the cloud orchestration engine is what you pay for.
Right. They could have that in mind as well. Yes. If you, Yep. Absolutely.
Well, we've seen that a lot. A lot of people are using, you know, SD-WAN fundamentally is open source products in the edge. And then there's a cloud platform that brings together into a unified, useful tool. So, you know, it's the same model.
Right. Yeah. So I don't anticipate Dent being all that interesting to the traditional enterprise. I think more focus there will be on Cumulus, Sonic, and your
I guess what I'm saying is there's nothing attractive there. There's nothing that makes me go, ooh.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, I understand what you mean. Yeah. I guess I just feel
there's something there, but
Amazon is big enough that when they do something like this, it piques my curiosity, say.
Well, we'll keep looking out for it, I imagine.
Yep, we'll hear more. Plus, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy connection is it's always going to suck me in.
There's definitely meat, but there's no sizzle, I think, as they go. Say in somewhere.
There's some
that's
steak,
an American
but no
trope of some sort, I don't
it
know.
It is, yes. All right, again, links in the show notes if you want to find out more. Let's move on. Light Readings reporting that an analyst firm says AWS is going to develop and deploy its own IP routing technology, displacing Juniper Networks. AWS is Juniper's largest cloud customer, according to this analyst.
Not news. We knew about this 2 years ago. AWS made an announcement that it was going to replace all third-party equipment in its infrastructure with its own equipment. Mm-hmm. And that was clear. You know, we talked about that multiple times over the last 2 years. And so for somebody to suddenly pop up and go like, oh, look, it's kind of like, duh. It's not new. Keep in mind that AWS is big enough to have direct relationships with Broadcom and other ASIC makers. And they would definitely be able to use the current family of Broadcom ASICs, to my mind, to replace the big routers from Juniper that it's been buying. And it wants to. It wants to own that because it believes that having its own teams means it can react. And it can also make its networks the way it wants it. It doesn't want to have generic networks that anybody can use. It wants to have networks that Amazon can use. And they don't look normal.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to build your network the way Amazon does necessarily. They have a very specific
so,
uses.
Yeah. If you're a network designer, you don't go and learn lessons from AWS and put it into your enterprise data center. That's just not relevant. What AWS's problems are only problems that AWS has at this point. So
I think more the thrust of this story was the impact on Juniper's financials. This analyst does put numbers saying that he anticipates it's going to reduce Juniper's cloud revenues by 6% in next year and 8% in 2022. So it's more about the financial impact.
Yeah, the analyst reports that I've read have been talking about that for 2 years as well. And the prediction, and Juniper is tracking on that, you know, as the cloud providers buy less and less, that's tracking, that's well known and well understood. The and Juniper, of course, knows this because that's why it acquired things like Mist and Apstra to bolster up its enterprise portfolio so that it can replace that revenue in the enterprise. We've been talking about that for well over a year.
Yeah, and we've been talking about other IT vendors, traditional legacy vendors, getting pinched by clouds when suddenly they stop buying their products or hold off for a quarter. I think we've talked about that in terms of Arista, HPE, and others.
That's right. And also the fact that Cisco's made astonishing amounts of money out of its campus portfolio and told shareholders such. And a lot of Cisco's competitors have realized that that's actually where there's a substantial market and they should move rapidly to get into it.
Yeah. So again, the hyperscalers are their own ecosystems. They can control their own destinies. That's essentially the point here.
Yep.
All right, moving on. F5 is going to spend $500 million to acquire Volterra. This is a startup that offers a SaaS-based API gateway, load balancer, and service mesh for microservices, VMs, and monolithic apps. It's also got a set of its own POPs and network backbone to connect to public clouds.
So I looked at this. This is a pretty conventional technology infrastructure. They are NFV play. They have a bunch of – they only have 20 POPs. It's barely – it's not that many. At this point, so it's a small company, and basically they have a bunch of NFV instances and a cloud orchestration platform. So if you want to think about it as like a service mesh, the idea is that you have these NFV POPs all over the place, customer sends a network into it, and once you do that, you then have an orchestration system to decide what you do with it. So Alkira, for example, uses theirs to do multi-cloud networking or networking as a service, so you can very quickly turn up networks from place to place and get visibility. Zscaler uses their service mesh to perform security inspection, logging, and threat detection. It's the same idea. Packet Fabric uses theirs for the more traditional network as a service model. So really, you know, the fact that Volterra has chosen to emphasize its geographic load balancing, SSL at the edge, cookie handling at the edge, observability is pretty much the same as any one of a half a dozen companies, including Cloudflare. And I don't see this as being $500 million worth of value, but it probably is a good complementary to F5 because it finally puts them in the public cloud network in the direction that things are going. That is, this network as a service, virtual instances distributed around the world, click some API buttons in the public cloud, and we've got your networking all up and running. It's the gap where Nginx didn't actually have any coverage.
Yeah, I guess my understanding is that there's another side to this aside from that network as a service aspect. They also have essentially a service mesh that would run inside your microservices application, not just in the cloud or wherever you're running the application. So it's doing that service mesh API mm-hmm. gateway that somebody like Kong or, frankly, Nginx would do, or Istio Envoy. So it's got both sides of the coin. It's got the network as a service, but it's also doing those complicated networking and security features right inside, say, your Kubernetes cluster. So they've got the local and the wide.
It does seem to have a lot of overlap with Nginx, doesn't
it? It does, yeah. So yeah. I'm wondering if F5 is hedging a little bit here. I also feel like this is allowing F5 to position itself against VMware Tanzu's service mesh.
Yeah, except Tanzu is not a hosted service. It's very much right. a do-it-yourself, yep. like you do-it-yourself sort of thing.
Right.
But then the other leg of VMware's networking strategy is VMware on AWS or VMware on Oracle. They actually have their own. They have the whole infrastructure hosted in other people's clouds type of thing. So they don't actually need the virtual service as much as, or maybe VeloCloud will come out with one, because VeloCloud could easily be adapted to deliver this same sort of service mesh in the public network type thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't strike me as an innovation. It strikes me as a me too. And to pay $500 million for a me too seems a lot of money. And the analyst report that I read sort of went like, yeah, okay, seems expensive. And there's also the fact that F5 has promised to return $1 billion in cash to shareholders over the next 2 years.
Wow.
And as part of that promise to not make any more acquisitions. So from now, I think we'll see F5 stabilize. Whether it wants to or not, because it said it's told shareholders it won't spend any more money on acquisitions.
This all did happen very quickly for Volterra. If you haven't heard of them before, they just came out of stealth in November 2019. So a very quick exit. Yeah, and at $500 million, that is a pretty high valuation. Although I guess I feel like if we're really seeing enterprises move to microservices architectures, you know, the way microservices have developed, they've kind of left the networking and security parts as their own domain. And so a company like Volterra can step into that void.
Yeah, I guess if you're running a bunch of F5 load balancers at the moment and you start doing multi-cloud, maybe that's the natural, they think they can tag that sale on the back of that. Maybe that's where it is.
Like I said, I think it's two parts. There's that multi-cloud play, but there's also right inside your Kubernetes cluster needing networking and security and policy services.
Why pay for a service mesh? There's a dozen free service meshes.
Because you have to operate themselves and they can be complicated to run.
Yeah,
so
Cisco's
you buy a service.
Got one, Juniper's got one. You know.
Well, that's competition.
Yeah.
That's how
but,
it goes.
You know, if you're a developer, you're probably not going to buy it. Say, I need to buy my Kubernetes.
I mean, I think F5 also sees the writing on the wall with VMware, you know, buying Avi and throwing software load balancers, you know, right into the vSphere platform and VMware, you know, right on the host. So they've got to do something. And this is their counter outside of Nginx.
Yeah.
So
I'll give you that. They do have to do something.
All right. As always, links in the show notes. Let's move on. At the end of last year, VMware announced it was suing its former COO, Rajiv Ramaswamy, after Ramaswamy took a CEO job at Nutanix. VMware alleges that Ramaswamy secretly met with Nutanix for 2 months while still employed at VMware, which the company claims is a violation of his contractual obligations.
I remember when I saw this post back in early December and didn't put it on the show because it was like, well, you know, it's just an executive moving between companies. Who cares? And executives don't actually make that much difference at the end of the day, as I've said many times. But in this case, VMware is actually suing him because apparently he secretly met with Nutanix for 2 months while still employed at VMware. Now, that sounds pretty normal to me. That doesn't sound, do you know what I mean? Like,
I mean, it does. If you're going to get a new job, wouldn't you? Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I sort of also understand VMware's point where they're like, he was in an executive and he was in all our secret strategy meetings and who knows what he's telling them, et cetera. And so, and I don't know what his contract says, but I also really think what this action does, my impression is that this action is intended to have a chilling effect on other VMware execs who may be thinking about leaving.
Well, I think the flip side here too is that if you're a senior executive, the normal rules don't apply, right?
Right.
To my mind, freedom to choose your employer is a key thing. You absolutely want to be able to leave a company and go to the next one as and when you want to, and, you know, make decisions. You shouldn't be restricted about where you want to employ. And if you have, if your employer has a non-compete clause, they have control over you by restricting your employment, and that means you can't leave. They're not preventing you from leaving, but if you can't make choices about where you go next, then effectively they're preventing you from leaving.
Right.
But, and, you know, and most often when these contracts happen, companies get something for nothing. That is, you give away the right to move to a competitor or to someone else in your industry, but they don't pay you extra. And this is the kicker here, is when you're a senior executive, you do get paid for loyalty. You are expected to commit to the organization. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's different from a regular line worker, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that guy was probably on $500,000 to $1 million or more, plus bonuses, you know, that mm-hmm. sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Their employment contract is different. So there's a thing, you know, I just not. Like the quote said, Mr. Ramaswamy demonstrated poor judgment and had a clear and extended period of conflict of interest. He should have disclosed this conflict of interest to VMware so the company could have taken steps to protect himself. He probably didn't know if he was going to get the job. That's a little bit facetious, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
So, and then, of course, one of the things about this, though, is that this tactic is very much an EMC tactic. So maybe the old EMC executives left inside of the rump of VMware. In fact, EMC was famous for being based in Boston. And the story I heard is that a large part of the reason they were based there was because that state of America has non-compete clauses by default.
I do not know.
And Joe Tucci was a big fan of non-compete clauses and rabidly enforced them, had an entire legal team basically chasing after people who went to competitors at every level.
Right.
Like working for EMC was a dead-end job because once you left, if you went to anybody else in the same game, they were coming after you with legal threats and so forth.
Yeah.
But I do note it didn't seem to stop somebody else because Pure Storage named AJ Singh as chief product officer this week. Did you see that one?
Is he also a VMware exec?
Yeah, he is.
Okay. Okay.
A bit different here in that he was in the cloud department and now he's going to Pure Storage.
Okay.
Which may be less of a conflict of interest perhaps, but you know, the fact that two senior executives have walked out the door of VMware might be sending you a signal in its own right.
Could be. And like I said, my own speculation is that VMware is letting other execs know if you're thinking about going elsewhere, do it a different way.
Yeah.
take some time off in between.
Yes. And or they don't want execs to leave and they're sort of sending out a message saying
that
we need to stop an exodus of executives. We would struggle to replace them.
Yes. Not to mention, tossing a lawsuit at this guy is going to tie up Nutanix's lawyers. And I'm sure VMware isn't sad about that.
Well, you know, there's nothing to be gained here. Like, why incur the cost of setting up a legal team and taking somebody to court and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, unless there's something to gain? And I'm not sure what you gain. You know, normally you just sort of say, okay, well, whatever, and exchange some angry letters and let it die down and walk away. But
right. Yeah. Well, we'll see how this plays out in court. I'm interested to see what happens.
Hmm.
In any case, that was our last story for this episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. Please stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Silver Peak SD-WAN customer Simon Med. That is starting now.
Today's episode is a case study of a SD-WAN deployment with Simon Med, a provider of medical imaging and radiology service. Simon Med sends massive 2D and 3D medical images across the country, and it needed a faster, more efficient WAN to serve radiologists and patients. We are sponsored by Silver Peak today. You know them for their SD-WAN capabilities. And our guest is Juleep Wickramanayake. He's the Chief Information Officer at Simon Med. Juleep, welcome to the podcast. This is your second go-round on the network. Let's have a brief little catch-up on Simon Med's network today.
Well, thank you for having me. So Simon Med is about a 16-year-old company, right? We have about 150 locations, mostly grown by acquisitions, mergers, and then new de novos, right? And then our WAN consisted of two MPLS mesh networks, and we manage about 300 site-to-site VPNs. And the biggest part of this whole quotient is that we move about a petabyte of data a year, and we acquire 850 gigs to a terabyte of data, depending on the volume for that day.
Now, I've been lucky enough to work in the medical industry, and particularly in the radiology market, and they really shift around a lot of images. Now, they are high-res images, and the idea is that the radiographer should be able to take an image and then ship it to the radiologist, who'll then be able to read it and make statements about what's happening on that image. So it needs to be good, but it also needs to be reliable, right?
Correct. So we have a couple of dilemmas here, right? One, first and foremost, we have 150 locations in about 10 states. However, our radiologists are located, you know, probably in 20 states, right? Mm-hmm. Because we do subspecialty imaging, which means, you know, if you have a neurologist or a mammographer, you know, they're not going to be in the same place all the time. So we want to be able to send these studies to the experts, right?
Yep.
And doing that, we have to be able to distribute that data in a way efficiently that they can read and perform the next study and the next study.
Right. So that's key. So now, you said before that you've got a WAN consisting of two MPLS mesh networks. I can only imagine how entertaining and challenging that was. What was the performance like?
Some sites, you know, your latency was good, and so there was no issues. But, you know, if you took most of the sites, there was twofold problem. One was that it wasn't size right. So you started off a site with only maybe X-ray and another modality, and then suddenly the operations decided to upgrade the site until about 3 months later when things didn't work properly. Hey, our network doesn't work. And then you had to kind of do upgrades. And, you know, with an MPLS network, doing any upgrade or lighting an MPLS network on any new site is usually, you know, 90 to 180 days, depending on where it is.
Unless
a connection existed, you know, it was almost impossible to do that.
I imagine because you're based in the US, you were also backhauling your VoIP over the top, but you're running telephony over it as well.
Correct. So we had PRIs at almost all those sites, and voice routers at all those sites, which was very hard to manage, you know. And even from a billing perspective, you know, you're talking like 276 invoices or more, or 300 invoices a month. And so having to go and make, see whether we are getting overcharged or not is almost impossible, right? So by default, if the vendor wanted to overcharge us, which they probably were doing, you know, you'd never know the difference.
So you're getting not great performance in some locations, which could have an effect on the radiologist trying to do their job and also potentially a patient waiting for information. I guess you were also having VoIP issues. Did you run into problems when you're trying to transfer files and also people having calls at the same time?
The network guys have done a pretty good job segmenting the network with, you know, doing QoS on the WAN side. So that was never a problem. The problem was when, you know, if a line went down, you know, how do you get this going?
Well, and I think part of the pain about an MPLS network for this is that you actually had to have an active in a standby, I imagine. And so you
we didn't have active standby. It was just
one.
Just one single connection. So, yeah.
You were spending millions a year just on a single network and no backups.
$5.4 million a year for voice and data, which was around at that time about 100 sites. Right.
Wow.
So you worked with a consulting firm to bring in software defined WAN.
Yeah, actually, I brought in SD-WAN, and I brought in a consultant. Yeah, the consultant didn't bring SD-WAN, right? So one of the things that I bring to the table is unconventional CIO. So I do not believe in conventional things. You know, just because it's like saying, "Hey, I didn't get fired for being IBM or Cisco," right? I mean, there's so much more technology coming in that is beyond your understanding. So for me, it is this. Okay, somebody tells me I can do that, and I go, "Okay, great, let's do a POC." If you can do that, I don't really care what the technology behind it is, as long as it's working, right? Mm. So I had done a POC with Silverpeak about in 2016, and they were not there at that time, but it still worked better than the conventional routing. So when I came to this job, it was bigger and we were moving more studies. It made all the sense in the world to move to an SD-WAN network, right? And as I say that, one of the things what you're doing is when you go to SD-WAN, you're future-proofing your network, your WAN, right? Doesn't matter what kind of technology. Look, 5G is coming today, right? I can put 5G in instantaneously right now at any site.
I suspect that most people will never use 5G for WAN technology or indeed for anything that actually matters, right? You won't actually go out and say, oh, I need a 5G for that. It will be a successor to 4G and you'll use it. But the point is that you could use it if that was what was available to you. Yeah. In the remote chance that 5G comes along, you could use that with an SD-WAN. You can use DSL. You can use cable. You can use direct internet access over some sort of legacy technology, you know, whatever it is. The thing about SD-WAN is whatever the telco wants to give you, you go like, sure, I'll just turn it into Ethernet and start using it.
And the reason I brought 5G is because we have mobile units, right? So today we are using 4G. Okay. And there are sites where we go to, you know, it's in areas, believe it or not, it's 2020. But getting a network connection is almost impossible. It's cost prohibitive, even other than getting a DSL connection. And then DSL doesn't work for images, right? You know that.
Yeah.
Too small. So therefore, that's when 4G and 5G comes into play. It might be a little bit more expensive, but at least we can get the files out of there. But,
and you're able to connect that into your SD-WAN network then to make sure you're getting the good performance out of the 4G?
Yeah, we are doing that with 4 mammography units today.
So SD-WAN over 4G is delivering the answers for you now, not an imaginary thing. This is real.
No, this is real, yeah.
Are you using the WAN acceleration capabilities of the Silverpeak?
Yes, we are. So we've invested in 10 gigs of WAN ops, out of which I think we are using about, 6.7 gigs of it. So one of the issues that we ran into WAN ops is our network engineers not understanding how to do WAN ops, right? So they're trying to put more WAN ops than the line is capable of. It doesn't work that way. So there was a whole education process that went about maybe not too long ago, six weeks ago.
Yeah.
And right now, it is performing well. So right now, you asked me about active passive. So what we are doing is we are actually getting active, because one of the things that SD-WAN has brought to us today is the fact that we can do remote scanning. So when I mean remote scanning, we have 150 sites.
Yeah.
MRI techs and CT techs can scan from point A and scan a patient inside, all the way from B to Z, right?
Because they can be in the next town over. The radiologists and the radiographers are the expensive part because they're a scarce professional resource, right? You can have a machine
This is the technologist,
right? Okay.
So we are using high definition cameras, right? So now we are doing. So not only are we doing imaging, we are doing streaming video.
Okay. Right?
Right. We're not recording the video, but we're doing streaming video, and it's ACR approved right now.
Yeah.
Where we can scan the patient. Where you don't have to have a CT tech, right? You have a qualified tech,
yes,
and a junior tech, and so putting the patient on the table, but the actual scan is being done, from Kentucky or Washington or wherever it is.
Yeah.
So the operator's not on site; they're doing the scan remotely. Okay, got it.
And that's not something that you were able to do before?
No, there's no way we'd be able to do that with MPLS.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, WANOPS is the one that makes it work really well.
Yeah, the secret to WANOPS is to be very careful about what you optimize. Like, don't try and optimize everything. The most common mistake is to say, I want to WANOP 100% of my traffic. And it's smarter to say, this is the bit that I can WANOP well, and I'm going to just do that and leave the rest alone, is what I found.
So my original team didn't know what to do with WANOPS, decided, to make me happy and put WANOPS across the board and almost brought the network down, right? So they had to revert it back. And this is the funny thing, right, about talking about people who don't understand conventional versus unconventional technology. Mm-hmm. This is a perfect example of that. So conventional router guys think, it's going to work like, one of Cisco boxes like Riverbed. Yeah, okay, mm-hmm. let me go put, and it doesn't work that way.
No.
So I want to sort of circle back around on the overall performance gains, because my understanding was it could take 10 to 15 minutes to get an image to download, which isn't great. What it was like after SD-WAN was in place?
So it comes between, depending on the file size, between seven seconds to about a minute, depending on, some studies are huge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as we do that, we are seeing a bigger gain in how radios can get to their studies. And one of the issues that we've had is that it's the right sizing of the line, right? So unfortunately, there are issues even with SD-WAN. There is a site that does mammography and they have a, 100 down, 30 up, right? Well, you can only get so much out of a 30, even if it's WAN optimized.
Yeah. Right? It's not a 100 meg circuit. It's a 30 meg circuit when you're uploading the images from site to the other. Have you tried ganging up more than two? So going to 4 DSLs?
We do. We do for the short term. Right. So we'll get a, month to month contracts with, either broadband or whoever we can get.
Mm.
And then we'll have a carrier build us a 100 meg circuit, right? Or 200 meg circuit.
So you're using that for speed to execution, using,
correct,
lots of DSLs as a temporary solution while you wait for a more traditional DIA circuit to be fitted out over, whatever months. That's really important because you want to be able to open, if you're consolidating radiology into a network and you want to bring on new partners, when you've got the momentum, quite often in the medical industry, once the momentum builds, the momentum builds. And you want to take advantage of that. And if you were frozen out of that saying, yeah, you know, we've got to wait for 100 meg circuits.
Yeah. So what happened to us was within during COVID is the fact that all these broadband and DSL connection that we used were performing very poorly because everybody went home. And guess what? All those broadbands are getting used big time, right? Yeah. So now we are struggling. Because it doesn't matter how good your SD-WAN is at that point. It's based on, you know, what you're getting from your carrier.
Yeah.
So that's why we kind of decided, okay, you know, it was great. You know, it was a great run to have it with broadband. But given the fact that everybody's using broadband, we had to go to DIA circuits. But again, so we are now slowly bringing those DIA circuits back and right-sizing our connections. As we right-size these connections, I mean, you know, we would have never been able to do what you call a remote scanning.
Yeah.
If we hadn't done SD-WAN, right? So because SD-WAN was already there, we were able to do that and become the first in the nation to do that and open our sites.
And you can't underestimate the fact that even if you've got active standby now, which you never had before, and so you've got redundancy. Sorry, not active standby. You've got redundancy, which you've never had before. Yep. But you've also got whatever you're paying for, you're using. So just because, you know, it's not active in standby, half of it's being unused. You're actually, what you get, you're using, and you can, and it goes into a lesser state when it fails. But that's okay because it was so much better than it was. It's not a business loss. Yep.
It's active, right? So what we do is we send certain traffic on one line and certain traffic on another line. So they're both used. Uh-huh. So you're getting total bang for the buck.
Telephony's working fine. You're probably sending faxes over those lines, which may or may not have been, you know.
So we centralized all our fax services. We centralized our voice services to SIP, right? So everything is coming into two data centers and the voice gets transferred over. So SD-WAN, at least Silver Peak, does voice segmentation really well. So nobody's ever complained about, you know, having voice not working. The only trick to that was, you know, when you had non-asynchronous lines, you know, you have to make sure your connections are made proper. Otherwise, you know, other person can hear you, but, you know, they can, you know, we can't hear them, right? So things like that happen. But within you know, quick time, we figured out all those things. And right now, we light up sites, right? Nobody even complains. It's up and running, and nobody even knows the difference.
Very
nice, yeah.
That's the best part, when you're not getting complaints, because everyone blames the network off the bat. I wanted to ask, you mentioned you were spending, I think you said $5, $6 million on WAN costs. Has that number come down?
It's come down to about $2.1 million, including the SD-WAN subscription. So,
but you're only halfway through.
Yeah, so it's only halfway through. No. We are at about, we are 114 sites on DIA.
Right.
And I think we are three sites away from total SD-WAN. So we are now on DIA and like one MPLS. Right. Mm-hmm. We've already taken away one MPLS, and there's only like six or seven sites left over with MPLS. And once that goes, we are completely DIA. And all our 150 locations are on SD-WAN.
Right. Okay.
So the upshot is you're going to come away with a net saving.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the other side here is the speed at which you've been able to act here, because you've only joined the company recently, like months, not years ago, and you've been able to bring this change in and execute on it quite rapidly.
Yes, we did. So we started this SD-WAN execution like May of last year, and if not for COVID, I think we'd have been done by now, you know, because at some point we could not get what I call remote hands out in the open to go to a site to, you know, even if it was closed, get them doing, right? So
you're sort of saying 16, 17 months to do 180 sites in the medical industry. That's still...
Correct.
Yeah.
It's still pretty fast, yeah. And not just sites, right? I mean, you know, we've also deployed to some of our remote radiologists, right? So we get this remote radiologist to go and say, hey, go get yourself a business internet connection because we need a static IP for management purposes. And then we send them a pre-configured box, they plug it in and off they go.
They're working remote, yeah.
So they don't have the overhead of the VPN.
Well, I'm afraid, Julie, that's all we've got time for. Hopefully the people listening have been inspired by your story. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to Silver Peak for being a longtime sponsor of the Packet Pusher, sponsoring sure that we can continue to provide you nerdy and technical content just like this. And speaking to people like Jaleep is actually somebody who's done this, and he's been telling you his story. It's quite good, I think. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, and find us on LinkedIn and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but never least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.